Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Gone to a medieval festival lately? What were they playing? Yes, playing. They were jousting, no doubt, perhaps sword fighting. That's what usually comes to mind when we bring up the phrase medieval pastimes. But just how did people who lived during the medieval period spend their leisure time? We'll find out in a moment when Talking History's Eileen Dugan speaks to Compton Reeves, author of Pleasures and Pastimes in Medieval England. But now let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1227, Mongol warrior, leader, and empire builder Genghis Khan died. Losing his father to a rival tribe at the age of 8, the young Genghis was taught many of the vital skills needed to be a Mongol chief by his mother. Genghis realized early how important it was to build an extensive network of allies to guard against both internal and external subversion. At the same time, he disregarded many of those tribal alliances once his needs had been met. Besides always outnumbering his many opponents, Genghis and his Mongol army used a brutal brand of psychological warfare to scare his opponents into early surrender. His outright massacre of enemy tribes across Asia added to his aura of invincibility, and by 1220, Genghis and his warriors had crushed his rivals. Unfortunately, Genghis's sons lacked his keen sense of organization and discipline, and under their leadership, the empire he spent his life forging crumbled. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, it's been over 200 years since the United States secured its independence from Great Britain, but investors are still interested in the documents behind the event. Recently, at a New York auction, a very interested bidder paid $635,000 for a letter written by John Adams prophesizing the difficult road to American independence. Addressed to Archibald Bulloch, a former member of the Continental Congress, the letter warns of a great expense of blood to be paid for freedom. It goes on to emphasize the importance of the upcoming Declaration of Independence debate, with the future president calling it the greatest debate of all. And recently released reports by the Clinton administration revealed that the CIA and other U.S. agencies held detailed evidence of human rights abuses committed by the Chilean Pinochet government shortly after the U.S.-backed coup of communist leader Salvador Allende. The reports, which the administration said would be released as an attempt at government accountability, become public in the middle of Spain's efforts to extradite Pinochet from Britain for prosecution. While many U.S. officials say the reports reveal nothing new about the brutal Pinochet dictatorship, human rights advocates add that the revelations cast a negative shadow on the CIA. Many wonder why the CIA did not step forward upon realizing the atrocities. You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back. As promised, we now turn to the question of the day. Just how did people who lived 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages spend their leisure time? They had no television, movies, computer games, or even radio. So just what did they do? Here to tell us all is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan and her special guest, Compton Reeves.
American leisure today is big business. We flock to big budget movies packed with special effects. We demand 200 channels of cable TV. We attend sporting events and buy merchandise related to our favorite teams and heroes. We devour the latest computer games, dreaming of defeating all competitors on the Internet. We buy sport utility vehicles to get to and from our multiplying leisure activities. What does all that say about our society and about us? We are well aware that it wasn't always this way. But then we have to ask, what was it like? How did people in the past entertain themselves? And what does that say about them? With us today to discuss the hidden world of medieval leisure is Dr. Compton Reeves, professor of history at Ohio University. Dr. Reeves is the author of Pleasure and Pastimes in Medieval England. Greetings, Dr. Reeves.
Hello there.
Why, in your opinion, is the study of leisure important to our understanding of the past?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we always have not only professional historians like myself, but particularly as we try to teach students, is to find a bridge between ourselves and the past. Past politics often seems very remote, but past leisure and discovering that people in the past, even though their lives may have been hard and difficult, managed to find time to play, just as we know in our own century that people in prisons or people in concentration camps found ways of entertaining themselves and ways to laugh. I think that if we're going to truly understand people who lived in the past, we have to know how they played as well as how they worked, how they conducted their political affairs and that sort of thing.
And how have 20th century finds contributed to the study of medieval pastimes?
Oh, well, it's contributed tremendously. First of all, I could say that simply the maturing of the academic discipline of history has been important, opening up archives and making more documents available. And by the way, there's still a tremendous amount to be done in terms of just making available documents that survive from 6, 8, 10 centuries ago. But beyond that, I think what has been very helpful and what I tried to integrate into my own work were some things concerning, physical finds, bone skates for skating on ice, the discovery of game pieces for chess or for backgammon or for other kinds of games. I think to be able to make those physical contacts with the past is also important. We all love to travel to places and see buildings and see where famous people were, but we can also go to museums and see pieces of jewelry, or we can see a manuscript that someone painted, or we can see a piece of stained glass or something like that. So these finds, not only documentary finds, but also finds of material culture, I think are extremely important in helping us bridge the gap between ourselves and the past.
Well, for most of us, the phrase medieval entertainment generally conjures up images of tournaments and jousting. What purpose did the tournament serve among the medieval nobility?
Well, the first thing to note is that tournaments did have to do with the nobility. They were very expensive pastimes to participate in because of the horses, because of the armor, because of the weapons, because of the requirement of a tremendous amount of leisure time to become the kind of athlete that it was necessary to be in order to participate, even to participate, not only to participate successfully in a tournament. The origins of tournaments have been, that's a subject that's been debated greatly, but apparently they originated in France, and basically the tournaments were training for war, training in the use of weapons from horseback, that is, it's mounted armed warfare. We call it cavalry warfare. The original tournaments were basically team sports with a team of warriors or knights on one side and a team on the other, and they would pick a day and a place and fight it out. But it soon became obvious that this was a very expensive thing. People got killed, and rulers wanted to protect their warriors. And so gradually there were introduced rules to refine tournaments. By, say, the 15th century, tournaments were pretty well regulated sports. They were still dangerous, still very expensive to participate in. Tournament armor, for example, was heavier and gave the knight less mobility so as to protect him better. But the tournaments served not only as entertainment for the nobility, I think they provided them with an opportunity to display their athletic prowess, their skill in horsemanship. Look at the upper crust of society today that plays polo. I think there's probably a certain kindred spirit there. But the tournaments were also a way of gathering the nobility together in a convivial way, and in some cases it was an opportunity to talk politics, to talk whatever other kinds of things. So there were many functions of a tournament.
Now, of course, the tournaments did tend to be among the nobility, but in your book you discuss sports and games that medieval people of all classes enjoyed. Could you discuss some of those, please?
Oh, my gracious. I discovered all sorts of things that people played. I mentioned a moment ago some of the board games, backgammon, chess, drafts, what we in the United States would call checkers. Card games were introduced toward the end of the medieval period, and so those were some of the more quiet kinds of games. Archery, bat and ball games. I suppose the bat and ball games are as instinctive as little children with sticks and rocks that they can whack around. There don't seem to have been many rules, or rules were made up as they went along. We don't have documents about rules for ball games, but there are certainly illustrations and mentionings. I have come across a number of regulations about playing what we might call handball by bouncing balls off of walls where church windows were being broken because people playing ball by bouncing it off near the windows of churches and things like that. Football was a popular pastime in various ways. The ancestor of what we would call in the United States soccer. And these didn't require set rules. They could be made up as the game was played, and often were rather vigorous games.
And speaking of churches, you found an illustration of monks and nuns at sport.
Oh, yeah. And I think that, if nothing else, also indicates that everyone looked for an opportunity to be distracted by some sort of pleasure or game playing, just like we are.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's one of the wonderful ways we can bridge the gap of time between ourselves and our medieval ancestors, to understand that they enjoyed being distracted by fun and games just like we do. And many of the games they played were similar to our own.
Yes, for example, the illustration of them playing at a bat and ball game.
Yes.
Now, what place did music have in medieval lives?
Well, music, it seems to me, was central. And it was accepted, work songs to assist, to break the tedium of heavy labor. We don't have many of these that seem to survive, but folk tunes and music are mentioned. One of my favorite mentionings of music in this context would be the poet. Well, he was a poet by avocation, but in his primary occupation, he was a clerk in the office of the Privy Seal in England, Thomas Hocklieve, who made the comment that it was awfully difficult being a scribe because he had to just, as he said, stoop and stare on the sheepskin and the parchment he was writing on, and he couldn't sing like at his work like laborers could. Music was also connected to medicine. We think that musical therapy is some sort of a new 20th century innovation, but medieval physicians understood that medicine and music were connected, and they, for example, would take a person who was depressed and prescribe lively, gay music to stimulate them, or someone who was very excited to play soothing, quiet music. So there were all sorts of ways in which music was important to people's lives.
And did medieval people have pets?
Oh, indeed they did. I found a difficult line for me to draw, say, with pet dogs, was where does the hunting, working dog leave off and the domestic pet begin. And I'm not sure quite where to make that line, but people did have pets. Cats and dogs were very popular squirrels, birds, rabbits. One of my very favorite examples of a strange pet bird was Bishop Hugh of Lincoln, who ultimately was canonized, St. Hugh of Lincoln, who died in 1200. He was reputed to have a pet swan that lived at one of the Episcopal manors where Hugh spent time, and the swan would follow him around, and part of this, I imagine, was trying to illustrate what a kind, good man Hugh was, which was a part of his sanctity, because swans are rather obstreperous beasts, but this swan followed Hugh around and tried to give him peace and quiet, and ran other people off and things of that sort in the stories about him. So all kinds of pets seem to have been possible.
One theme which appears time and again in your books is the attempt by authorities, ecclesiastical and secular, to regulate pastimes, clothing, even manners. And some of their laws would appear to many of us today as being excessive, if not absurd. Why did authorities feel that such control was necessary?
I think for the same reason that we find today legislators attempting to control things that really can't be controlled by legislation. They were, for example, an authority thinking that it was, let's imagine some very pious type authority thinking that it was improper to spend time playing games when it was more appropriate to be listening to sermons, or the English government thinking that it was inappropriate to be spending time playing tennis or playing football when young men ought to really be practicing archery so that they would be available for good soldiering should it be necessary. I think part of it was the fear that any authority feels that people are not are going their own direction and not following the lead of the authority. But there was also a tremendous gap between the passing of legislation and the observance of legislation. Some of the legislation, for example, also had to do with clothing, what was appropriate to be worn by different classes and ranks in society and so on. Those laws were repeated over and over again, which, if nothing else, indicates that no one paid any attention to them.
And there was ritual protest. For example, the custom of the boy bishop at Christmas time. Can you explain that?
Well, this, I think, is, again, just an expression of the exuberance that sometimes appears in the records and sometimes doesn't. And it was perhaps, in the case of the boy bishop, a way of giving an acceptable channel to the exuberance of youth. And most of the large churches, there would have been choirs that would have had young boys who would provide the high-pitched voices that were needed for the music. Here's another example of music being central to life. And those boys would be educated in the school attached to the church. But boys, being exuberant as young boys are, didn't always want to follow the lead of being sober and quiet and under control. And so there was a tradition of, in the Christmas season, having a period of time at some churches, we know for sure, at Lincoln Cathedral, for example, of a bishop or the office of bishop being filled in a pretend way by a boy. And I wonder sometimes, too, and I don't know how this can be documented, but if this isn't another example of children imitating their elders at play, as little boys today might play cowboy or policeman or something of that sort, little medieval boys play priest or played bishop, and here it was given recognition, and he, of course, would not be, a boy bishop would not have the powers to celebrate the Eucharist or something of that sort, but would go through rituals and celebrations and fun.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. So thank you very much, Dr. Reeves.
Oh, you're most welcome. There are a great many other things that we might talk about. pleasures and pastimes are something that is perhaps universal to the human experience.
Right. Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Dr. Compton Reeves, professor of history at Ohio University, author of Pleasures and Pastimes in Medieval England.
In 1989, Chinese demonstrators, mostly students, carrying the U.S. flag and displaying models of the Statue of Liberty, demanded that their leaders make Western-style democratic changes in their government. 10 years later, nearly to the day, student demonstrators denounced the West, calling for revenge against members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization for their bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Why the change in attitude? Was it just the embassy bombing, or is there more to it? Here to explore that subject in our op-ed of the week is Ryan Dunch, professor of Chinese history at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. Professor Dunch has titled his piece for us today, Bombings, Blood Debts, and Mutual Suspicions.
A blood debt must be repaid with blood, shouted demonstrators across China after NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade on May 7th, killing 3 Chinese citizens. 10 years ago, the same Chinese proverb echoed through Hong Kong, with quite a different target, the Chinese government, for its bloody suppression of the democracy movement on June 4, 1989. Then, as this time, the demonstrations were massive, impassioned, and brimming with patriotic anger. In Hong Kong that June, the number of marchers on some days neared 1 million people, a staggering one-fifth of the total population. The same slogan, but different targets. Why? In brief, because the Chinese government has, since 1989, cultivated a sense that China is under threat from hostile international forces, and that patriotism means siding with the Communist Party against those forces. The sense of international threat emerged soon after the June 4th crackdown. In July 1989, a long article in the official People's Daily explained how the anti-communist forces of the capitalist world, led by the U.S. government, were engaged in a coordinated effort to undermine world socialism through peaceful means like the Voice of America. Events of the latter half of 1989 made this view look positively prophetic. One after another, most of the world's communist governments collapsed in an eerie reversal of the Cold War's domino theory. Then, in 1991, astonishingly, the first and greatest of the communist powers, the Soviet Union, annulled itself. The eagerness of leaders in the self-styled free world to claim credit for the victory lent credence to the Chinese government's conspiratorial view. The result is a climate of suspicion in China, in which any dispute with the United States is seen as another U.S. attempt to weaken China and its socialist system. The allegations of Chinese nuclear espionage are only the latest in the long line of such disputes over recent years. And now a similar climate of suspicion towards China prevails in the U.S., and the relationship between the two powers looks set to plummet to its lowest point since Nixon's historic China trip in 1972, with perilous implications for the coming century. What both sides must remember is that the pragmatic recognition of common interests, despite great differences, remains the only viable basis for the U.S.-China relationship. As Nixon himself put it in 1972, while we cannot close the gulf between us, we can try to bridge it so that we may be able to talk across it. 27 years later, the gulf remains wide and the bridge all too fragile.
You've been listening to Ryan Dunch, professor of Chinese history at the University of Alberta. Professor Ryan's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we continue on our medieval theme by calling to your attention a castle, once a medieval stronghold, in merry old England. Here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Depending on how you like your castles, Warwick Castle, located 8 miles from Stratford-upon-Avon in the bustling antique center of Warwick, can be quite fun with everything you would want in a castle and more. There are parklands, peacocks, towers, and a dungeon, all in what some call a theme park atmosphere. Castle Warwick owners, the Tussauds, have included wax figures in the recreation of an 1868 weekend party. Authentic smells and tales of the past battles are encountered throughout the castle. There is much in the way of history, including jousts, medieval hand-to-hand combat, along with a falconry exhibit on many weekends in the summer. It's a visit that truly leaves you with a sense of the history behind the castle.
Thank you, Cindy. And for those of you who can't get to England but still wish to explore the medieval world, try The Labyrinth, the website resource on medieval studies, which can be found at the Georgetown University homepage. And for those interested in more recent history, rush on down to the New Orleans Museum of Art for Degas and New Orleans, a French Impressionist in America. The exhibit, which closes August 29th, chronicles the artist's stay in that city from the fall of 1872 to the spring of 1873, with 17 paintings Degas created during his visit, as well as photographs, correspondence, and assorted objects from the rooms in which he lived. For further information, call the New Orleans Museum of Art. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on William Shakespeare. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.